Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On December 16, 1965, brother and sister John and Mary Beth Tinker and their friend Christopher Eckhart were among a small group of students in Des Moines who wore black armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War and to support a Christmas truce called for by Robert Kennedy. Five students, including the Tinkers, were suspended for their demonstration, and that incident led to Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District, a landmark Supreme Court decision that guaranteed First Amendment rights for public school students. The decision came down 50 years ago on February 24, 1969, and the Tinkers have been spending this anniversary in Iowa, speaking to students and community members in Des Moines and Ames. They've got two events left. They'll be in Iowa City today with a panel discussion at the Old Capitol tonight at 7:30 and another one tomorrow evening in Des Moines at Drake's Cowles Library at 7 p.m. They've been also using this tour to amplify the voices of young activists, and they even have their own ray gun shirt. Mary Beth and John Tinker are here with me today. Hello.
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 Thank
it's
you.
Great
thank
to be you. With you.
Yes. Well, it's wonderful to have both of you here, and I know you've told the story many times, but let's go back in time to 1965 to where this idea to wear these black armbands first came about. How did you decide to do it?
Well, the armbands had been around for a while before we started wearing them. Actually, our first experience with wearing black armbands was in 1963 after four little girls were killed in Birmingham, Alabama by the Ku Klux Klan, who bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church. So in Des Moines, some people had a memorial service and wore black armbands at that time also. But the idea of black armbands goes way back through history. It's a symbol of mourning for the dead and of sorrow and sadness.
And your family was no stranger, I mean, not just to those black armbands to mourn the little girls who were murdered, but your family was very involved with activism on a lot of different fronts, right, John?
That's right. Back in a small town in Iowa where our father was the Methodist minister in town, there was a family, just one black family in town, and the kids of that family were not permitted to use the public swimming pool. So when our father found out about that, he took the issue to the town council, and they declined to rectify the situation. And beyond that, the members of the church board opted to not renew our father's contract. And so we moved to Des Moines, where he had another church, and a kind of a similar thing happened there. Our mother made friends with the people involved in the civil rights movement as soon as we got to town, basically. And very shortly thereafter, we had black friends, whom we invited to church with us. And the church in Des Moines also did not want to have black people in their church. And so they also did not renew our father's contract. So he then began working with the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization, very pro-peace and anti-war. And his job title was Peace Education Secretary. So his job was to bring speakers, lecturers, and to have symposia and things like that so people could learn about world affairs and war and peace issues. So we grew up in that environment. In 1965, there was going to be a large march in Washington, D.C., the first large march to protest against the war in Vietnam. And our father helped to organize two busloads of Iowans to go on that march. Some of them were from the State University of Iowa here in Ames, and some were from Grinnell College, and some were from the University of Iowa in Iowa City, some from Drake University, and also just concerned citizens. But I had asked if I could go along on that bus ride, and I was allowed to go. on the way back from that march, there was a discussion on the bus what we might do in order to continue to protest against the war. And that's where the idea was raised that we would wear black armbands to protest the war. So some of us on the bus belonged to a church youth group in Des Moines, the Unitarian Youth Group. And we took that idea to the youth group, and pretty much all of the kids in the youth group agreed that that would be a good idea, and we planned to wear armbands. But one of our members wrote an article for his school newspaper at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines explaining what we were doing. We were planning to wear the armbands to mourn the deaths on both sides of the conflict and in support of Robert Kennedy's proposal for a Christmas truce that year. Well, when he wrote that article, the student newspaper advisor took it to the principal at Roosevelt, and he got on the phone, and the principals in Des Moines had a meeting, and at that meeting they decided to ban the wearing of armbands. So we weren't sure what to do. We decided to wear them anyway, and we got kicked out of school, suspended. And so from there, we decided to sue the Des Moines public school system in the federal courts for denying our First Amendment rights.
Well, and John, remind me, what grade were you in?
I was in 10th grade at North High in Des Moines.
And Mary Beth?
I was in 8th grade at Warren Harding, and I was 13 years old. And when we decided to challenge the suspensions, the American Civil Liberties Union got involved right away, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, which is one of the hosts with us this week, for us this week. And so they said, first you have to go and negotiate with the school board and try to change their mind first. And so that's what we did. And we went to the school board meeting, and several of the school board members did vote for us, but they decided to continue the ban on armbands.
So when you decided to challenge this and to take it to court, of course, it got a lot of attention. What was that like for your family? Because although Chris Eckhart was also involved in this suit, and he passed away a few years ago, your name was all over it. The Tinkers were front and center. What kind of a reaction did you get from the public?
Well, it was very much a group effort. It certainly wasn't just the Tinkers, and there were 5 students that were suspended, in addition to several students who were not suspended, but who did wear the armbands. So it was, some people really got mad about what we had done, and I think sometimes people misunderstand what patriotism really means, but some people decided we were being unpatriotic, and they threw red paint at our house and called us communists and sent us, you know, mail that was threatening. And a woman called on the phone, and when I answered the phone, she said, "I'm gonna kill you." It was really surprising for us, especially as kids, although we had the example of the civil rights movement and the young people who had been involved there, and we knew what kind of violence they had faced and endured, and some of them had been even killed. So compared to that, the harassment that we got really wasn't too significant. And also we had plenty of supporters too there in Des Moines, and actually from around the country and even around the world. I remember a letter from Nigeria that we got with someone saying that we should speak up and express our views for peace.
Were other students at school vocal about this, John?
Well, not at my school especially. I had friends. I had a kind of a circle of friends, and I would say that they did support me. Actually, most students probably didn't have much of an opinion at all about it. I was at the lunchroom the day that I was suspended. I had my armband on, and some kids came over, and they were harassing me. They were calling me a commie and a coward, a pinko, that sort of thing. And one of the football players from North High came over, and he said to those kids, he said, "You know, you have your opinion about the war, Well, John has his opinion about the war, and John has a right to his opinion, so leave him alone.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty good.
So when this case went to court and went through the appeals process, I mean, it took years. You guys were kids. You were growing up. You were doing other things. Mm-hmm. How engaged were you with that whole appeals process?
Well, it was mostly handled by our wonderful lawyer, Dan Johnston, for the ACLU. And we would go in and give testimony, written testimony, and then we did appeal. I mean, we appeared at the district court and the appeals court, and I went to the Supreme Court. But, you know, life went on. We would go roller skating, and I would go to slumber parties and birthday parties and study for school. And, you know, we went swimming in the summer. Life went on. But the bad part was the war went on as well, and it kept getting worse and worse. And so our sorrow that was really a lot of what motivated us in the beginning did get worse as it went on. And, you know, 1969, when we finally won the case at the Supreme Court, was one of the worst years for casualties in the war among the Vietnamese and the U.S. soldiers. So when we finally won, it was a little hard to be too happy, although, of course, we were happy about the victory, but the war continued, and that certainly was very hard.
Yeah, we testified at the trial court, the federal district court in Des Moines, but we didn't testify at the appellate court. There it's briefs that are presented by the lawyers for both sides. An interesting thing that happened for me at North High was I was invited to speak with various classes about our case and about the protest and why I was opposed to the Vietnam War. So I was actually invited by teachers at North, by several, to talk to their classes. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today are John and Mary Beth Tinker. And of course, you're familiar with their names. They were part of a protest back in 1965, part of a group of students that wore black armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War and support a Christmas truce. That incident, they were suspended, and that incident led to the Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District decision, a landmark Supreme Court decision that guaranteed First Amendment rights for public school students. That decision came down 50 years ago on February 24th, 1969. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me, John and Mary Beth Tinker. They were two of the students back in 1965 who wore black armbands to school in Des Moines to protest the Vietnam War. They were suspended. That incident led to the Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decision that guaranteed First Amendment rights for public school students. They are celebrating, we are marking the 50th anniversary of that Supreme Court decision. It was on February 24th, 1969, and they've been all over Des Moines talking to students and community members and in Ames. They'll be in Iowa City tonight with a panel discussion at the Old Capitol at 7:30, and tomorrow evening they'll be in Des Moines for their final event as part of this Tinker Tour at Drake's Cowles Library at 7 p.m. And I want to go back to the day that the decision came down, February 24th, 1969. Do you remember where you were when you found out?
Well, I do. I was a student then at the University of Iowa, and I lived in a dormitory. And I was in my room, and the phone rang, and it was a reporter from the Daily Iowan, the student newspaper at the university. And he announced to me that that we had won our Supreme Court case, and he asked me how I felt. And I remember I told him I was glad.
How about you, Mary Beth?
I was in high school in St. Louis by that time, and I remember going home and finding out then our father was on his way to be involved with the Paris peace talks, and so he wasn't there. But I remember my mom went out and bought some ice cream and soda pop, and we celebrated with my little sister Hope and little brother Paul, who had also worn armbands to their elementary schools in Des Moines but had not been suspended.
from that moment, how do you think the decision affected you personally? What did it mean to you in your life?
It was so important, although I didn't realize it at the time for some years. I grew up and I became a nurse, and I worked mostly with children and teenagers. And I started seeing firsthand how kids don't really have a fair deal in our society, the way things are set up. Their schools are often cut. The budgets of their schools are being cut. They deal with a lot of pollution and they have asthma. And every 3 hours on average, a child or a teenager is shot and killed in the United States. And I was a trauma nurse. And so I just started to think maybe there's something in my experience that I could share with them to help them, to encourage students to speak up and stand up for themselves and for their own interests.
And how about you, John?
Well, I'm not sure which affected me more, if it was the case or if it was the continuation of the war in Vietnam. I really suspect it was more the war at the time. We didn't really recognize the importance that the case was going to have for some years later. But I was very influenced by the continuing war, by the nuclear arms race, by the pollution problem, and I became disenchanted, I have to say, with the normal career path, I dropped out of school. I moved into a truck, a 1941 Ford, and moved into a woods, lived in a woods north of Iowa City, and had a kind of a Henry David Thoreau experience, which I value greatly, by the way. But I guess we had accomplished something, so I felt like I felt like I'd already done something. In another sense, I felt like I had to do something else, or it would be the defining feature of my life.
Oh, interesting. So did that put pressure on you? Did that make you feel like there was a lot of pressure since you had already been part of this?
In a sense, it took the pressure off. I felt a little free to go ahead and chart my own course, and I did chart my own course. I dropped out of the university and pursued my education on my own career path. I did a number of jobs. I worked on a shrimp boat. I drove a city bus. I did all kinds of things, and I studied programming and became a programmer. I wrote, by the way, the industrial byproduct database for the state of Iowa. So I also worked on a telecommunications software team and did that for a while. And I finally moved to a small town in Missouri where I bought the old public school building where I live now with my wife and family. And we have the community radio station. I'm a radio engineer. I worked at a small radio station in Iowa City and became a radio engineer. And so I built a station there in Fayette, Missouri. And the antenna's on our roof.
So amplifying voices in that way, for
indeed,
sure.
Indeed.
So in deciding to do this tour, and Mary Beth, you and I talked, and John, you joined that program as well not that long ago. You've been doing a lot of talks over the last several years with students traveling the country. In deciding to mark the 50th anniversary by coming back to Des Moines and talking to students in classrooms, you have also made the decision to use this opportunity to amplify the voices of student activists and student journalists of today. Mary Beth, what is the vision for this tour? What are you hoping people will get out of this experience?
I'm hoping especially that young people will be inspired and encouraged to use their First Amendment rights to speak up about the issues that affect their lives today. And it's really been heartening to hear so many young people who are doing that. A young girl at the high school actually was telling us a few days ago that her issue is agriculture and having a healthy earth and not using chemicals and taking care of animals. And other students are talking about racial justice and, girls' rights or the climate issue and so many other things. And we are so honored to have been joined this week by the students from the Eagle Eye, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School newspaper in Parkland, Florida, where the students were killed last year, and also to be joined by student journalists from Texas and from Arkansas in our celebration this week, because besides the free speech, students need free press. And the museum has just declared this whole year to be the year of the student journalist. And so there are campaigns going on all over the country for high school students and college students to pass legislation that will protect their free press rights. And 14 states now have done that. Iowa already has legislation like that. And so other states now are wanting to do that too. But it's a week of celebrating young people who are involved with free speech and free press and speaking up for their rights as well.
Absolutely. And it's very encouraging to see the interest among the young people in the schools today. I have a lot of admiration for my sister and the work that she's done in promoting the First Amendment among the students.
In choosing the students who would accompany you, I'm curious about the kind of communication that you had with them before this tour. How did you get to know them? How did you select them?
Well, I left my hospital about 6 years ago and just decided to travel around the country full time. And so I went to a number of schools that year in 2013, almost 100 schools. I was joined with someone from the Student Press Law Center, Mike Hestan, one of their attorneys. Now, a number of schools all over the country wanted us to come and talk to the students, but we could only go to one school in Florida. And it just so happened that it was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And so we made some connections there. And when the shooting happened then last year on Valentine's Day, of course, we reconnected with them. And so we were so happy to have one of their students speak at our program on Friday at the State Historical Society of Iowa. So that was the Parkland students and then their journalism professors that came from Arkansas with their students. And Iowa journalism students were meeting with all of these others at the Des Moines Register Friday night. And so they had a chance to really share their experiences. It was really great.
We are at a really interesting moment in time, and we've seen a big resurgence of public marches. We've seen the Women's March and the March for Science, and the March for Life is a very big event in Washington, D.C. So there are all kinds of activists that have become very visible. We've also seen, especially since the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, we've seen a lot of student protests about gun violence. We've seen a lot of walkouts at different schools. We're also seeing a growing movement among students trying to raise awareness about climate change. Having come of age in the 1960s during a time of a great deal of protest, what does that experience help you see in this moment in time?
One of the students told me that we're living in mighty times, and I have to agree. So much like the times that we were living in growing up, and it's a time when young people really are speaking up and standing up. In Iowa City, I had a call last week and talked with the students about the efforts there to fund the Labor Center, which is, I think, 80 years old now, and their campaign to do that. And there are so many other, everywhere we go, there is something going on where young people are speaking up and standing up to advocate for their interests, and it's so heartening to see.
When we were students in the public schools, we had, the boys had in front of them the prospect of being drafted and going off to Southeast Asia to be part of that horrible war. Then for a long time, there was not a lot of student activism after that war ended. And people said, well, that's because there's no draft and so on. But now we're seeing the rise of other issues. For instance, the global warming is a big issue that a lot of people can see, and it's staring us right in the face. And the gun violence has the school shootings. I mean, that is a horrible kind of a new phenomenon in the last 10 or 15 years or so. And so the kids feel this palpably, and it's really energizing a lot of them to think that they really need to raise their voices and deal with these problems.
And it's really wonderful the way that the March for Our Lives students and the others that have organized around gun violence have reached out to the students of color who are less likely to be shot in mass shootings, but on the streets and individually in the neighborhoods and in the urban areas, rural also.
Are much more likely to be victims
mm-hmm. yes.
of violence. In talking with so many students in the past week, not just the student journalists, but the students who have been in your audience as well, I'm curious, have the students themselves, have they brought up anything that you were surprised by that really made you think this week?
Well, I was a little surprised to hear a fifth grader at one of the elementary schools say that his issue that he's speaking up about is corruption in our courts.
Huh.
But the kids, I mean, so many are really paying attention and they see these things and they hear about these things and they really think about it. I was talking with a sixth grader yesterday who was talking about the tendency to be suspended in his school instead of the teachers and counselors working with the students, which he thought would be much better. He said, in his words, he thought it would be better for the students to be embraced by the administration instead of to be punished. So, I mean, students are thinking about these things.
I should point out that I've mentioned the national issues and the global issues, but a lot of students are concerned about local issues that come up at their school. There might be a teacher that's doing something bad or the administration has a rule that they disagree with. It might be the school uniforms or something like that students want to speak up about. And I'm impressed with the willingness of students to speak up these days. I saw a video of a group of students confronting Senator Feinstein in California about the Green New Deal and global warming and so on. And she was asking them to kind of take it easy a little bit, and they were not going to stand for it.
Well, your names come up frequently because free speech comes into conflict in schools. There have been so many events over the decades where the question of is this free speech or is this not free speech in a school setting becomes an issue. Do you feel like free speech is protected in our country, in our schools today?
Well, the schools are a special situation. We have compulsory education in this country. And the schools need a certain type of an environment in order to conduct classes. And so you don't have the same rights. Students do not have the same rights to freedom of expression in a classroom that they would have actually in the hallway or on the street. And that's articulated by Justice Fortas in his decision, his written opinion in our case, that the rights are not the same, but within those boundaries that they need to maintain an educational environment, students do have a right to let their opinions be known. And so I guess that's sort of the compromise that we have to make because of the nature of schools.
The Tinker ruling says that students have free speech rights except for substantial disruption of school or impinging on the rights of others. Whatever that means, and that's been debated ever since. But the substantial disruption part of it comes directly from Freedom Summer in 1964, when students wore buttons there to protest the murders of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, who were civil rights workers in Mississippi. And our case and our experience is so rooted in the civil rights movement, and we've been really talking about that this week in Iowa a lot, and we were so honored to be joined by a real icon here, the son of Edna Griffin, who was the Rosa Parks of Iowa, and our good friend, our family friend, Stanley, Edna, and the daughters and their father growing up. Edna Griffin started the Congress of Racial Equality in Iowa, and our mother was very much involved with that as well. So these, this ruling of the Tinker case, some of it comes directly from the civil rights movement. The substantial disruption test, for example, that is still in effect today in public schools comes directly from that summer.
Anyone that's interested in this issue, I would highly recommend that they read Justice Fortas's opinion in our case, because he rallies all of the arguments in favor of free speech in our democracy. And he does a really good job of explaining why it's important in the schools that we not slight the First Amendment, that if we're going to raise students to be participants in the democracy, we have to raise them to understand that we believe in the First Amendment. It's not just words out of our mouth. It's something that we really believe in.
John and Mary Beth Tinker, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be back in Iowa, and best wishes to all of the listeners and to everyone who cares about the First Amendment and is keeping it alive by using it. Thanks again for having us here today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charity.